C1SP. Number 14A.
Now, today and tomorrow we are going to have a big overall picture of this fourth chapter, Christian Science versus Spiritualism. And it is a nice incident to have to be able to recapitulate today the first and second part, and tomorrow to have the third part, so as to have the whole chapter together in one presentation. Because I feel this chapter on Christian Science versus Spiritualism is a very crucial chapter, so to say, because we come to a certain point in the development of our way of life where we really get down to rock bottom reality. Now, the first three chapters, prayer, atonement and Eucharist and marriage, were preparing our thoughts gently and gently, really to prepare it to accept this fourth chapter, which is in the tone of the word of science, namely in the tone where science now explains really what was going on behind the scenes, so to say, during the first, second and third chapter. And now we are piercing through in this fourth chapter to reality, to that point really where Mrs. Eddy asked now is the day of salvation, where she says that we can picture now the new heaven and the new earth, where she says that every man can understand and can get hold of this new heaven and this new earth, and where we begin to see that behind the first and second and third chapter was always one thing working, namely God and not the human efforts and not the human will and not the human desire, but God. God is, as she says there, that worketh with you to do, worketh in you both the will and to do of his good pleasure. We will touch today and tomorrow a wonderful basis from which to go out, namely that basis of God's perfection, of perfect God and perfect man. So I think this weekend should do a lot of good to us, and we should expect that it is going to do a lot to us. That this weekend really, if we have prepared our thoughts during these last 2 years for it, and if we really have the courage, it speaks a lot about the courage to accept what really reality is and presents to us, I think we should get a wonderful sense of freedom and salvation from the world of mortality. That if we see through these pages, we will experience a freedom that sets men free to master the infinite idea, to master the infinite idea of God. And so let's just be aware all the time that we are not here for an interesting talk, that this talk should not be the best ever, but that we are witnessing now and at present a freedom and a liberation from the world of material thinking. The world, not only the world of matter, but the world of material human thinking. And that we are taking hold in consciousness of the only true world of reality, the world of the divine mind. And if we do that, and in proportion as we do that, we can see that it will bring us a freedom and a vastness and a salvation which is worth everything. Let's make therefore this occasion of today and tomorrow a real living experience. A real living experience which we will remember all our life. That we break down the barriers of mortal thinking, that we break down really the barriers of all these entangled thoughts and of mortal thinking. And so lift ourselves right out in a scientific consciousness into a universe which is the universe of reality. Well, that's what is awaiting us today, definitely. And today and tomorrow, definitely. Now, today I want to recapitulate the first and second part and try to show what really this fourth chapter wants to present to our consciousness. You see, it is a big exposition of the question of duality. The question of duality, spirit or matter. Now, she doesn't bring up this subject without any preparation. No. Through the first three chapters, she was preparing thought to that point. You see, when we consider what she was saying to us about the subject of spirit and matter in the first chapter, there she only postulated first, so to say, the antitheses of spirit and matter. She didn't say more than that. She just postulated the antitheses of spirit and matter, showing that to be with God means to be with spirit and not with matter. That's all. But then, in the second chapter, in Atonement and Eucharist, she went one step further, and she showed that therefore we must advance beyond matter, that we must put our hope beyond the veil of matter, and that we must advance beyond matter. It's still the antithesis now, the antithesis which has been presented in the first chapter, now gets a direction. We are asked to take the right direction in this antithesis and to get away from matter towards and advance towards spirit. And in order to do that, she postulates in the third chapter, when she speaks about this antithesis of spirit and matter, she says, therefore, in the third chapter, let's give to the spiritual ascendancy. That the spiritual must have ascendancy over the material. It's still an antithesis. But already now we begin to feel that the weight is laid more and more and more on the spiritual, on spiritual affection, on spiritual qualities, and that in this way the side of spirit in the balance, in this balance of spirit and matter, becomes heavier or stronger and stronger, more important, more potent. And so she ends that third chapter finally by that crucial question where she says, now, after all that, do you teach that spirit creates materially, or do you declare that spirit is infinite and matter therefore out of the question? So for the first time, at the end of the third chapter, she questions and puts before the reader the question, well, after all, then, is spirit all and matter nothing? And leaves it at that point, because now the fourth chapter, which we are considering, is now investigating this on a purely scientific analysis. Is it so that spirit is all and matter nothing? And if matter is nothing, why do we have then a consciousness of matter? What then is that consciousness of matter? That's the second part. And third, how do we get rid of it? That's the third part tomorrow. So we can see that step by step Mrs. Eddy tries to lead thought of the student, of the beginner, step by step, further and further to this final question now, what is it? Is spirit real or is matter real? Is understanding, therefore, a spiritualization of material thought, of matter? And is demonstration, therefore, a materialization of spirit? or what is understanding, what is demonstration. And so she has to tackle all these questions of the duality, the belief in the duality of spirit and matter, of spiritualizing matter and materializing spirit in understanding and demonstration. Now, how does she, through the pages, deal with this all-important subject? We know that right in the beginning, the marginal heading is the infinite one spirit. And she goes out from that standpoint that God is spirit and that God is infinite, that God is the only and the one, therefore that only the spiritual is the all and the only. If we stick to this proposition, to this premises, if we stick to that, then we begin to see that any deviation from that point, whatever that deviation may be, must be denounced as Christian Science and must be called spiritualism. That everything that deviates from the concept of the all-pervading, one, infinite spirit can no more be called Christian Science, but must be called spiritualism. And we have seen how she, for instance, shows that the moment that we try to divide divine mind into many minds, or the one spirit in many spirits, or the one soul in many souls, or the one being into many beings, that we drop from the high standard of Christian Science and really accept the claim of spiritualism. So whatever limits in any way and in any direction, be it in the way of inclusiveness, in the way of power, in the way of all presence, whatever limits the infinite presence of spirit in our thinking, in our acting, in our feeling, in our concept, in our attitudes, whatever tries to limit that is spiritualism, is a belief in spiritualism. And so we can see that spiritualism is not something which has its origin in God, but that spiritualism has its origin in the human belief, in the human belief of limitation in any way and shape and form. That spiritualism, therefore, is a creation of the human mind. That spiritualism is not a reality or a system or an entity which exists somewhere in reality in spite of the human thought. The only thing that exists in spite of human thought and thinking and feeling is God. He is the immutable God. And whatever does not conform to this divine spiritual principle has its origin in human thinking. And it is important to see that so that we don't feel or think that spiritualism is somewhere an outside aid, as she calls it, an outside aid. But therefore we can rely on spiritualism as a self-existent and a self-expressing system and rely on it as a help. But that we begin to see through it, and we will analyze that afterwards, begin to see through it that it is has its origin in human beliefs and in human thinking. So we understand that scriptural note right at the beginning of the chapter, that scriptural note which shows that we should not ask the wizards that peep and that mutter, but that the people should ask God. We should not seek unto them that have familiar spirits, but the people should seek unto their God. It shows therefore, that we should not rely or try to rely on human beliefs. These are the spirits, on human limited concepts, on concepts of limitation of good and evil and so on, but that we rely wholly on God. Should therefore a people seek unto their God, unto God who is principle and not to human beliefs. If we do, then the scriptural note says, verily, verily, I say unto you, if a man keep my saying, he shall never see death. Shows that in that measure, as we turn, always turn to the wholeness and infinitude and oneness of God, then we turn to the one infinite spirit, and turning to this one infinite spirit is keeping the commandment, and that is always life. In other words, spiritualism claims that in asking spirits and in relying on spirits, we will find immortality, or we will find communications of immortality, or we will find some utterance of truth coming from immortality. And that through that means we are in communicable terms with immortality. Whereas the true sense of it states that only as we are one in communion with the one spirit, that then we have life. In other words, that only that in our whole experience on this plane of existence, which is in line with the absolute consciousness of spiritual things, that only that really lives. That everything which in us, which is not in harmony, not in communion with the one unlimited spirit, that is not immortal and will die and will have to go, and does go. So we come to a very crucial point, namely a question of, which I would say it's a question of death and life, or you say a life and death question, which says, well, what really has immortal life in my whole experience? What in my whole experience will have the quality of immortality, of real life, and not just of superficial life, of a beginning and end life, of a life that comes and goes? What is it? And it says, only that which is in line with spirit really stays, has the quality of life. So, this chapter asks us, therefore, to turn to spirit, and in turning to and addressing ourselves to God, we will find the answer for life. That's why this chapter is in the tone of the word as science. The word is always that which says, go and turn to God, not to beliefs. Go and turn to God. But how? And so science must come in and say, well, it must be in a scientific way and not in a way as the five physical senses would tell us to do, because only science can truly analyze a situation quite contrary and in opposition to the five physical senses. Science alone, scientific reasoning, scientific logic can uncover a situation which the five physical senses couldn't, and science alone can show the nothingness of a claim which is fooling the five physical senses constantly. So we come here to a very big exposition of the reality of being, spirit, which asks us to rely on scientific reasoning and not on the testimony of the physical senses. That's what the introductory paragraph already tries to point out, showing, as I feel at the present moment, that that very first paragraph tries to introduce the three big subjects of the three big parts of the whole chapter. First, showing that mortal existence is always an enigma, and that the physical senses can never tell us what is real and what is elusive. Showing that therefore science must come in, that not the physical senses can really inform us anything about true life, about the reality of life, but that this mystery of mortal existence must find its solution, and the only means that can solve a mystery is scientific thinking, scientific logic, science. And science tells us that spirit naturally only manifests itself spiritually, that spirit cannot lose its identity, and therefore that spirit, therefore, because it cannot lose its identity, can only bring to birth and create only spiritual identities, and they are life. Whatever comes from God has life. So in the first part we will see how through six subjects she depicts what spirit really creates as spiritual identities of being. Having then shown that, then spiritualism comes and says, but the physical senses testify to the contrary. Spiritualism comes and says, with my five physical senses, I can disprove this first part. And so the second part comes in and says, all right, I take it up with the five physical senses, and I'm going to show through science that the five physical senses are liars, that their basis, that if I reduce the testimony of the physical senses down to rock bottom, I always arrive at mortal mind or a human belief. I always arrive at the cause which is not God, but which is outside God, next to God, beside God, usually a human cause. And so uncovers that in spite of the testimony of the five physical senses, only that which is in line with the one spirit is really true. That only that which is in line with that mind which is spiritual, that mind which is spiritual, that only that is true. And that everything else which is not in line, which is not spiritually minded, which is not in line with the mind that is spirit, is a lie, no matter how wonderful it looks to the senses, no matter how supernatural it looks to the senses, no matter how phenomenal it looks to the senses. Science in the second part comes and uncovers the lie of the physical senses and the phenomena perceived by the physical senses. Having shown that and uncovered that, then in the third part, tomorrow, we'll see that therefore only that mind which is in rapport, which is in communion, which is one with spirit, and not that mind which is one with spirits or beliefs, that mind which is in line with the divine spirit, with the divine mind, that alone reflects God, and that mind alone is able to give birth to our true spirituality, that mind alone has the ability to bring forth in us the perfection of being, the admission to our own self that man is God's own idea, sets man free to master the infinite idea. That's how she begins it. And gives a big sense of freedom and salvation that sets in the moment we have discarded the belief of the physical senses and the phenomena of the physical senses, and have discarded them as fabrications of mortal mind. And then as we turn our mind to the divine mind and fill our mind with that which is divine mind-like, then something in us is going to happen, namely, then the scientific evolution, the scientific development in us is taking place and is leading us to that end of that chapter where she ends with God's perfect spiritual man. She begins the chapter that mortal existence is an enigma, and she solves that enigma right through the chapter until that she ends with God's spiritual perfect man. Wonderful range of the whole chapter. And I think we should just be overjoyed that we find a chapter in the whole universe that will show us a way out of this entangled business of mortal thinking, and that disentangled the interlaced ambiguities of mortal thinking. Because all what we have to do, and all what troubles us from morning to night, if we are troubled, but what troubles us is our mortal thinking. Is that how we look at things? Not reality can trouble us. Reality is harmonious, and reality is a presence. Now is the day of salvation. That's the passage that comes in over and over in that whole chapter. Now is the day of salvation. We have now the right to be free. And we don't have to free ourselves of some outward spirits, of some independent spirits, of some entity called spirits or beliefs. We have to free ourselves of our false concept of reality, of the reality of being. And it's up to each one of us, and every man can understand it. It's a gorgeous chapter. And we should free ourselves during this weekend of this world. We should be able to say after this weekend, I'm not of this world. I'm from God, and I come from God, and I return to God. I'm never of this world. If we believe that we are of this world, we are spiritualists down to the bones. How does she show how we get out of these entangled ambiguities of mortal thinking? And so she takes the first part. Let me quickly go through that first part, though we have recapitulated it last time already, but it's good to see the big lines in it. The first subject showed in that first part that the eternal identities of being are always formations of the divine mind, and that whatever is finite is not a creation of this divine mind. She shows that the creation of God, of reality, of mind, is a creation of ideas. These ideas are real, and these ideas have identity, and these identities exist not in a finite form. But if we start, instead of starting with God, if we seek unto wizards that deep and that matter, and unto those who have familiar spirits, if we start not with God, but with the human thinking, with the human brain, with human beliefs, with our dream existence, then she says, all right, you can put up a creation also. And she shows that you, which she has as defined as finity, she says, close your eyes, and you see, and you behold, and you think, and you, and you, and you. See, in other words, she shows, yes, mortal thought also tries to be a creator and tries to create a universe, and then, having created that universe of mortal thought, believes as a next step that this universe of thought is real. And the next mistake it makes is that it believes that this universe of mortal thought is from God, and it's God's universe, and attaches it and identifies it with God. And so we have, right in the beginning, this antithesis of creation, which shows that we have to see very clear what is the creation of the divine mind, the universe of divine mind, always infinite ideas, and what is the universe of mortal thinking, always our dream stuff, our dream universe.